Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. Hard to believe we're almost at the end to another week. Time sure does go by quickly, but at the same time, you know, we don't have control over how quick time itself moves. But as I've said before, and I'd say again, it's up to us as individuals as to how we choose to make the most of the time that we have each day, given that time itself is simply not something that should be taken for granted. So I do know this much. We are closing in on the end of this podcast book topic series. I want to say that we'll probably have at least one more episode to go after this one, maybe two, but I'm hoping it'll be one more. Nonetheless, I mean, it's been a great one. I know that all of you whom thought you knew everything there was to know about ICE have learned more than you ever expected. And when I read this book, I certainly learned, for the first time, I certainly learned a great deal about it, but it was very well worth the time. And while I had learned some basic stuff about ICE in terms of 101 stuff with ICE houses, I have certainly come to appreciate, especially through having read this book, the entire process of how ICE went about getting harvested, to how it went about being insulated, and most of all, Frederick Tudor's grand envision. And I've said this a lot. Yes, there were people who scoffed at him. People from all walks of life, most notably within the inner circle of the elite, being the Brahmins, a.k.a. the wealthy elite, elite Protestants, whom, yes, Frederick's family was a part of. But yet, what do you know? The greatest deal of ridicule was from within that inner circle. But as time went along, and with the trials and errors that came with it, the trials and the successes prevailed. And yes, Frederick was adamant that it was him who started all this and nobody else. The fact of the matter still lies to this day that Frederick Tudor was able to do things that were impossible. Frederick Tudor was able to ship a commodity that went from one region to another, going from a cold climate to tropical climate, and the commodity still retained its uniform, its structure. Yes, meltwater may have melted from the ice, but all in all, by the time it reached its destination, whether it was 16,000 miles across the ocean, from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean in Calcutta, India, to St. Pierre, Martinique, to Havana, Cuba, to Charleston, South Carolina, Mobile, Alabama, to New Orleans, Louisiana, Key West, Florida, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Baltimore, Maryland. I could go on and on. The bottom line is, folks, is that ice harvested from Massachusetts' lakes, rivers, ponds, to Maine's Kennebec River and elsewhere in the New England region, a true reality for all the most relevant purposes, proved to be an amazing success. And yet it's an amazing success story that has been forgotten all these years, more so since the invention of modern-day refrigerators. Well, yes, modern-day refrigerators are great, but we have to be reminded of the fact that ice houses were refrigerators of their time. Yes, at one time, maybe only a certain group of people could have afforded them. But as time went along, ice itself could be made accessible to the greater public. And yes, as Frederick Tudor said, wouldn't there be people in the elsewhere in the world in tropical climates who would kill to have a nice chilled beverage with some ice, or be able to enjoy their dessert, or anything that would have the potential to spoil, but thanks to ice, would greatly reduce the spoilage? Well, if I lived in a tropical climate and I saw ice for the first time and put it in my beverage, crushed ice, I'd probably be on cloud nine. So, you know, whenever we have a beverage and it has ice in it, let's not take it for granted, because there was a time when not everyone had access to ice. Well, in this podcast segment episode to the frozen water trade, we're going to learn where things go after Frederick Tudor's passing, but we should also take into consideration that we do need to be reminded of what of how things did change once the Civil War began, the United States Civil War, I should say. Once that infamous Civil War between the states began, we have to wonder, what about Frederick's shipping industry? In other words, or his shipping business, I should say. You know, here he was, prior to the war between the states breaking out, he was having, you know, success shipping ice to New Orleans, to Mobile, to Savannah, Georgia, Charleston, South Carolina, Norfolk, Virginia. I name these spots because they're southern cities, but we're going to have to wonder when we start learning about this, how are these places going to be impacted by the frozen water trade, given that North and South are at war? Well, we'll find that out. So let's get ready for our first leadoff question to this podcast segment episode of the frozen water trade, how ice from New England lakes kept the world cool. Here we go. Here's our leadoff question. After Frederick Tudor died in 1864, just how abundant had winter ice become within the greater northern United States? Well, thanks in part to enhanced techniques from cutting, storing, to shipping the commodity more efficiently, general demands for requesting ice increased year by year. So when you have improvements in how ice gets cut, to how ice will get stored, and how people can go about shipping the commodity itself more efficiently, just about anything is possible. And if all three of those things prove to be all the more possible and doable, then not only will the demands for ice itself continue to increase, but volumes of overall ice shipments will constantly be increasing year by year. So if you don't reform your techniques, like cutting, storing, to shipping the commodity, then the demand itself is going to go down, because then people are going to be left to wonder, how do we go about securing the ice to ensure that not only will we have it tomorrow, but how do we go about ensuring that the ice itself will still retain good quality, you know, a couple of weeks from now, maybe a month from now, depending on how well it's insulated. Come the 1880s, so, you know, Frederick Tudor dies in 1864, so come the start of the 1880s, he's been gone for a little over 15 years. The ice trade industry has thrived throughout the states of Maine, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Fleets of ships are still involved in the practice of transporting ice per the East Coast trade, whereas railroads were now making their way into places never before. Well, railroads at this time, prior to the 1880s, in the early years of the railroad industry, we were looking more of like north to south. But in the post-Civil War era, now when I think of post-Civil War era and railroads, I think of the year 1869, when the Transcontinental Railroad was getting built, that, you know, was the first major railroad that linked east to west. Well, in the 1880s, railroads are expanding to places never before, like the greater Midwest. So you could take a train ride from New York, perhaps all the way to Chicago, Illinois. There is now train service, perhaps from Chicago into the Dakotas, because it's in, I want to say in 1889 it was, or in the late 1880s, that North and South Dakota became states. So, you know, the railroad is doing wonders, not only in just getting people from points A to point B, but how about, you know, delivering goods that perhaps never could have been done before? I do know that, for example, after the Civil War ended, that there were delicacies that were able to be canned. that had not been able to have been done so before, because there was really no way of properly chilling the delicacy. So when I think of a particular food that was not able to be transported, say, by rail and get to its end destination within a short time frame, how about lobster? I know many of you are thinking, why lobster? Well, you know, lobster is something a lot of us could take for granted. You know, you go into grocery stores. I know there are a couple of grocery stores where I live, near where I live, and there are lobster tanks. And yes, you can have, you know, you can get lobster for dinner. Hey, that's fine. But to think there was a time when if you wanted lobster for dinner, you had to go to the coast. You know, you didn't get lobster inland. But anyways, in the post-Civil War era, trains going from New York to, from Boston to New York, from, you know, Portland down to New York, were actually transporting canned lobster chilled with ice so that consumers, most notably in New York and Philadelphia and maybe Baltimore, could enjoy a delicacy that was really only reserved in the New England region for a long period of time. So this is now, thanks in part to better means of transportation that can not only, as I said earlier, not only gets people from points A to point B a lot faster, but how about getting delicacies a lot quicker, thanks in part to a greater demand for ice that can be designed to chill food and beverages, not only just for local or personal consumption, but for a broader population. So, although New York remained by far and wide the largest market source for ice consumption per beverage, drinks, food delicacies to ownership of domestic refrigerators during summertime, what industries come the 1880s began to make their presence known? Hang tight here for just a moment, and I'll be right back. You know, I was really surprised by this one. Maybe it shouldn't have come as a surprise, but here again, it's something that a lot of us could take for granted if we're not careful. The answers are the brewing and fresh food industries. You know, when I think of brewing, how about beer? So many American people during the 1880s became intrigued, not just became intrigued, but they acquired a strong taste for German lager beer. All right, this is something pretty exciting. But there is a disadvantage. It's a disadvantage that pertains to beer. How so? Well, beer just can't be brewed whenever people want to brew it. Beer itself can only get brewed properly if placed at lower temperatures. All right, and if beer is required to be brewed at a lower temperature, what is that going to require? It's going to have to require some form of refrigeration in terms of keeping the temperatures where they need to be in order for the process to proceed forward, to go all the way through without any issues. So basically, without refrigeration, the lager itself could only get brewed during winter time. All right, so to think at one time, brewing beer could only be done seasonally, being in the winter when it's cold. But the emergence of ice now has enabled brewers to work year-round, thus allowing the beer industry to grow rapidly. Now that you have ice, now that you have ice houses to that can do so much more, not only in terms of preserving your foods to where they don't go bad, but now beverages can last a lot longer. So now people can enjoy beer a lot longer versus something that they could only enjoy on a seasonal basis previously. greater beer consumption led to a higher demand for ice supplies in hotels and homes. And what do you know? Milwaukee, Wisconsin, home to a large German population who contributed heavily to the beer manufacturing industry. You know, the baseball team, Major League Baseball team called the Milwaukee Brewers. That's probably how they got their name, largely in part because of the brewing industry in terms of how beer goes about getting brewed. Thus, it makes sense. Milwaukee Brewers. Now, something else that I've known for some time, and this is probably something that we should also be reminded of, that as much as people loved having a glass of beer, I mean, who still doesn't enjoy having a glass of beer from time to time? If you are, I'm more of a wine person, but I don't mind having a nice glass of beer from time to time either. But I've definitely become more of a wine person over the years. My wife and I are big time wine drinkers. But I do know this: there was a downside to beer, and not just for beer, but for liquor, especially liquor. The downside to alcoholic beverages like beer and liquor was that there were many, individuals from whom were a part of the temperance movement who sought to abolish liquor and alcohol or any form of alcohol within their community. They were firmly convinced that alcohol ruined families. And we should be reminded, folks, that previous generations before us, not just in the 20th century, but before, in the 18th and 19th century, for example, many families were broken up because of a parent, most notably the father, being an alcoholic. And there were no such things as AA treatment centers back then. But one of the reasons why Prohibition eventually came about was because those who were a part of the temperance movement were firmly convinced that alcohol destroyed the family, and that being addicted to alcohol led those to stray away like lost sheep. I'm just reporting some facts on that, but that is something that many were very afraid of, was that an ever-growing demand for beer, an ever-growing demand for liquor would not only be consumed at high levels, but if it went unregulated, those whom would consume it would become so heavily addicted to it that it would make them do things that were unbecoming, such as walking out on their families to basically dying from, of course they didn't know it back then, but dying from, say, cirrhosis of the liver, aka liver cancer. And you know, the doctors know these days that if you consume too much alcohol, it could destroy your liver over time. But I do think it's important that we get back on track. But with anything that comes about, there's always the good side, and then there's a not so good side. But we should be reminded of the fact that there was a time when beer itself could only have gotten brewed during the winter season. But because of the greater emergence of ice year-round, that will now enable brewers to work year-round, thus allowing the beer industry to grow rapidly, which it did. Now, prior to Frederick Tudor's passing, Head Maine's Kennebec River served as an emergency source of ice when Massachusetts's rivers, lakes, and ponds did not totally freeze over. Yes. But not long after his passing, starting around the 1870s, the Kennebec River, including the rest of Maine, became the chief supplier of ice per last resort grounds when a majority of the eastern seaboard from cities like Baltimore, Philadelphia, Washington, New York, and yes, all the way up north to Boston, experienced what was called an ice famine. A severe shortage of ice on their waters, and that could be attributed to the fact that the winter was not a severely cold one. It was a mild one, It wasn't cold enough to where those rivers, lakes, and ponds endured hard frosts to where those bodies of water were able to produce enough of a ice crop to where they would have exceeded the minimum quota of ice harvested. New York City folks often found itself relying on Maine ice quite regularly from the 1870s up until World War I's end. So from the 1870s, folks, and World War I ended in 1918. So that's almost 50 years, folks, that New York City found itself relying on Maine ice. Yes, New York City probably did have some harsh winters to where they were able to cut their own ice, but they often found themselves at the mercy of having to rely on a state to the north to supply their ice, given that they were experiencing a deficit. In other words, they could have been 2 million tons short of ice from, say, the previous year. So it's one thing to be short one year, but when you have drastic fluctuation, thank goodness you have somebody else that you can rely upon. But then you have to wonder what happens one day from now when Maine starts to experience an ice famine. Who do we turn to next? So there's a lot of what-if scenarios that some cities to the south of Boston, and especially with the state of Maine, that we'll have to contend with on a year-by-year basis. Hang tight here for a moment. I know some of you are saying, now, Kirk, that's twice now where you've said hang tight here for a moment. What's going on? Well, you know, when I'm doing a lot of talking, I know that I need to stay hydrated as well. Not only by having water, but why not have a nice cup of hot tea? You know, you live in Virginia, Kirk, and it's hot right now. Why are you having hot tea? Well, I like drinking hot tea any time of the season. And the bottom line is, as long as it tastes great, that's all that matters. And my wife and I, not only are we big wine drinkers, but we love a good glass of tea. So, hey, there's nothing wrong with that. Was Boston still allowed the right to ship or export out ice during the Civil War? This is where many of us have to ask ourselves, how does the Civil War change the way Boston ships out ice? And remember, you know, Frederick Tudor was alive for a good part of the Civil War. I mean, he died the year before Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox to General Ulysses S. Grant. So, and we also have to be reminded that Frederick Tudor died in early February of 1864. He lived long enough to see the Federal forces, or aka the Union Army of the Potomac, defeat Robert E. Lee's Army of the Northern Virginia at Gettysburg. He lived long enough to see Ulysses Grant defeat Confederate forces at Vicksburg. Both sieges or battles, campaigns, I should say, taking place in early July of 1863. So Frederick Tudor saw a lot of fluctuation in the Civil War. He learned left and right firsthand of just how many Union generals Abraham Lincoln had to go through. In the Eastern campaign, he went through at least five at one point. I want to say George Meade was probably the fifth general he had to go through. And luckily, George Meade prevailed. He proved to be very successful at Gettysburg, although historians have said that had George Meade followed Lee in retreat, as Lee was retreating, Meade's forces probably could have caught Lee's retreating army in a surprise so big to where some historians have said that the war could have ended 2 years earlier than, say, in 1865. But there will always be those what-ifs out there. But the irony to it is that Frederick Tudor lived long enough to see a lot of uncertainty. And as I mentioned in the previous podcast, he lived long enough during the Civil War to wonder what would happen if there was no United States. What would happen to everything that I had worked so hard for in terms of proving all these skeptics wrong? What happens to my clients in the southern states whom have loved receiving ICE? What happens? Well, let's find out here. Was Boston still allowed the right to ship or export out ICE during the Civil War? Believe it or not, folks, yes. However, there is a stipulation to this. President Abraham Lincoln did issue a blockade. That is, the blockade itself cut off all trade entering into Confederate ports. So when I think of Confederate ports, I'm thinking like, you know, Norfolk, Virginia, Wilmington, North Carolina, Charleston, South Carolina, how about Savannah, Georgia, Mobile, Alabama, New Orleans, Louisiana, just to name a few of what would have been a fair number of southern port cities whose importance was vital in allowing supplies to be sent into those cities. But the Union Navy thoroughly prevailed in blocking off all means of getting a supply of preventing supplies for the most part into these key strategical Confederate port cities. But the city of Boston was allowed, as a compromise per the Lincoln administration, the city of Boston was allowed to ship ICE into the East Indies, aka, you know, India, Sumatra, as a means for making up lost revenue tied to the New Orleans trade. All right, so Massachusetts is going to be okay. They're just going to have to ship. They're going to have to ship their ICE to places where they've already been shipping it to, but it has to be internationally. Now, the ICE trade, though, helped benefit the Union Army immensely during the Civil War. And I'm sure some of you are wondering, how did the Union Army benefit from the ICE trade? Well, a guy named James L. Cheeseman, yes, folks, Cheeseman, C-H-E-E-S-E-M-A-N, yeah. James L. Cheeseman, whom was a New York ICE harvester from the Hudson River Valley region, he established operations at the village of Farmingdale on Maine's Kennebec River. And after the Civil War hostilities had first broken out, Mr. Cheeseman won a contract to supply the Union or Federal Army with ICE at high prices. His practices led the way to establishing an ICE trade between the state of Maine and the cities of New York, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, and Philadelphia, where come the 1870s, the state of Maine outdid Boston, Massachusetts's overall ICE trade practice by hundreds, and if not hundreds, how about thousands of tons of ICE per year? Well, it is good to know that Boston could still transport ICE. They just couldn't do it domestically. However, ICE was able to be transported domestically, but it had to be through means of contract and an approval from the Lincoln administration, but only to benefit the Union Army. The Civil War saw Boston thrive with India ICE trade, most notably from 1864 to 1866. The Tudor Company made a profit, get this, folks, they made a profit of $377,000 from Calcutta alone. Well, we have learned that Calcutta, India, was the biggest recipient of ICE, given in large part because there was a large British community living in Calcutta. While, yes, places like Bombay and Madras, India, did receive their share of ICE, the populations weren't as high as, say, in Calcutta. Now, in 1870... starting around 1870, the ICE trade with India began to decline. You know, trade, you know, we always like to think that trade with one nation including another lasts forever, but at some point the trade itself begins to decline. I often wonder why, but sometimes it could be due to factors that are, you know, maybe beyond control. For example, like maybe supply has over exceeded the demand. Maybe the demand has exceeded what the supply can in reality accommodate. Now, you know, we did learn earlier about the New Orleans ice trade, and we're going to I have a question for you all regarding it here, but even after I mention this particular question about the New Orleans ice trade, I'm not going to go away from it altogether. I will come back to it again before the podcast segment episode is over with, but nonetheless, it's probably not a bad idea to get rolling on it here, given that, you know, in this Civil War, it's not just one region that is impacted, both regions are, but we're also in the fight to keep America intact. But the biggest, you know, issue is trying to end slavery altogether, and the fact that it had to take 5 years and nearly the loss of about, say, between 500,000, 600,000 people's deaths, not only soldiers, but civilians. I mean, people think that, you know, we do have to be reminded that, yes, in Vietnam, there were just shy of 60,000 men and women being nurses whom lost their lives in the conflict over in Southeast Asia. But that, you know, pales in comparison to what happened in the United States Civil War. It's a sobering statistic, but yes, you know, for 600,000 people to die in a 5 year conflict, I mean, it's very scary knowing what the realities of what war onto itself brings to a nation that, when the war itself ended, it still took a long time for the nation to fully heal as one. And of course, many of us probably are led to wonder, had Abraham Lincoln not been assassinated by John Wilkes Booth, would he have been able to have completed the second term? Many are left to wonder, had Lincoln not been assassinated, he would have handled things a little bit differently. I'm under the belief that Reconstruction would have been handled differently. So many things would have. There will always be those what-ifs. But anyways, let's get to this question here regarding New Orleans, and hang tight here for a sec. So how did New Orleans manage to survive during the Civil War, given no ice was received due to President Lincoln's blockade measure? Top-level leaders within New Orleans found means to have two artificial ice-making machines be smuggled from France through the shipping blockade. Man, so somehow top-level leaders within New Orleans found a way to get some artificial ice-making machines smuggled from France through the shipping blockade. Just when we think every nook and cranny and every square inch of water is covered in terms of protection to keep a blockade intact, sometimes people from within whom have been punished often find ways to beat the system. And yet, top-level leaders within New Orleans found a way to do just that. So these machines were found instead to actually help cool hospital wards versus replacing all supplies of natural lake ice. Artificial ice-making machine is nothing. The concept behind inventing artificial ice-making machines did not happen during the Civil War. They have actually been experimented with for some time, and they have undergone a lot of trial and error. But we are going to be surprised to find out before this segment is over just how doable it was for artificial ice making machines to have their significance be made known. So artificial ice making machines in New Orleans did help mark the beginnings of the commercial ice manufacturing industry in America. Artificial refrigerator had primary importance in southern states like Louisiana and Alabama, given the main sources of natural ice lied way further north, and demand is not high in the northern states and cities for manufactured ice. Well, think about it. Up north, it's going to water, lakes, ponds, and rivers are going to freeze a lot faster, and therefore they've got the means, really, we could say, like in their own backyards, to cut the ice. And yes, you know, they could certainly keep what they feel is necessary for them to you know, to help their families. But also in a time of war, though, where is that leftover ice going? It's going to the Union Army. It's not going to be supplied to the Confederacy, because if we supply, ice companies up north are going to be supplying ice to the Confederate Army, then President Lincoln's going to think to himself, who are these people? What side are these people on? Are they truly allies to the Union cause, or are they Northern sympathizers whom are sympathizing with those down south whom are trying to cling on to a way of life that I myself know isn't truly relevant, along with many others in northern states whom don't see this evil institution as a proper, relevant, functioning system. What key element was responsible behind the demand for Maine ice? Yearly winter weather conditions, including the temperatures. This is going to sound like a crazy scenario, but this is how Maine harvesters want it to be. Maine harvesters sought hot summer temperatures down south, followed afterwards by a mild winter that would destroy ice harvests in other key production states like Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania, and Maryland. Well, a first happened about 4 years after the Civil War ended. We go to the winter of 1869 to 1870, and harvests, not just one harvest, but multiple harvests, failed along the Hudson River and elsewhere south of Massachusetts and Boston. And yes, folks, even Boston herself was not exempt either. So how did ice companies along the Kennebec River go about resolving this problem? Well, within a few weeks, around 300,000 tons of ice was cut along the Kennebec River to send to destinations from Boston to Boston, Massachusetts, New York City, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., and Baltimore, Maryland. So, you know, here a crisis of a first has now taken place. And, you know, if you live in, say, Philadelphia or Boston or Washington, yes, you are very thankful to have the Kennebec River in Maine, given that that river freezes over everyone else's rivers. It seems like it just seems to freeze. It has a knack for freezing very quickly and for freezing hard. So if you know you're in a tight squeeze, you've got an ally, even if it's hundreds of miles north of you, but it will still make its way there. Late 19th century saw Kennebec River, including other Maine rivers from the Penobscot to Sheepscot, freeze solidly over to depths. Get this, folks. This is pretty awesome in terms of statistics. The late 19th century saw Kennebec and other Maine rivers from Penobscot to Sheepscot freeze solidly over to depths of 18 inches or more. All right, well, you know, there's 12 inches or in a foot. So if you've got ice that is 18 inches, that has depths of 18 inches, that's 1.5 feet thick. That is I mean, if I saw firsthand for myself ice that was 18 inches or more thick, I think my jaw would drop. It's not something I should take for granted. None of us should, because just because you walk on ice, it doesn't mean that the ice is secure. You know, if the ice hasn't gotten a hard, solid freeze, you'll fall through it. But just because you're walking over a foot of ice that's thick, that doesn't mean something can't happen. But the bottom line is that for the Kennebec and Penobscot and Sheepscot to freeze solidly over to depths of 18 inches or more, then these other cities to the south know that their quotas can be met, knowing that these rivers are going to always freeze hard, and they won't ever, for the most part, they may not have to worry about shortages short and long term. So ships are sailing southward to these cities, and while these cities south have received their ice surpluses, there is one particular city that did something very admirable in return for the captains commanding the main schooners. The captains of the main schooners in Philadelphia, that's right, folks, the people of Philadelphia gave the captains of the main schooners coal. Now, I know many of you are thinking, how in the world can they find coal in Philadelphia? You find coal in western Pennsylvania around Pittsburgh. Well, that's true. But believe it or not, I had read a book some years back called Coal, A Human History, and just to the north of Philadelphia, most notably, when I think of mountains north of Philadelphia, I think of the Poconos in around on the outskirts of Scranton, close to the Pennsylvania-New York line. But there is a type of coal called anthracite. Anthracite is it's a hard coal that has a level of hardness that's very high. It's not when you try to scratch it, it's not going to come undone. In other words, it's a heavier weight feeling versus traditional coal, like bituminous coal that you would find in, like say, in western Pennsylvania, West Virginia, or perhaps in southwest Virginia into eastern Kentucky. So, yes, in return, the captains of the main schooner ships, once they had delivered ice to the customers in Philadelphia, they got coal in return to send back up to people in Maine whom would need to stay warm during the brutal winter season. Well, I mean, how else are you going to heat your fire? I mean, you've got to put coal in your fire to keep that fire stoking. Remember, folks, we don't have anything like, you know, modern-day gas logs that you can turn on and off. We don't have anything like that, but people, you know, they need something to keep warm, and they need to have the coal to stoke the fires. What did cities from New York, Washington, Philadelphia, and Baltimore, per their individual ice companies, proceed with performing after the mild winter season of 1869-1870. They all agreed, yeah, get this, folks, they all agreed to purchase land along the Kennebec River's shores, thus enabling them to construct large wooden ice houses. Okay, so company officials, you know, per these cities that I just mentioned, okay, yes, none of them may have direct ties to Maine, but the state of Maine is allowing them to purchase land for each company, for each various company in these states. They're being allowed to purchase land along the Kennebec River shores that would enable their employees to go about constructing large wooden ice houses. I almost wonder if that's going to lead to some rival competition that, you know, could get nasty. Because just because, you know, companies are allowed to construct their own large wooden ice houses, that doesn't mean that they're all going to abide by other people's rules, or maybe I should say properly abide by their territories. Despite the owners of the ice all being outsiders like the Knickerbocker companies of New York and Philadelphia, the ice industry in Maine still remained local. But at the same time, people from various professions were able to further grow business-wise. Which people would have been able to have further grown business-wise? How about the blacksmiths, the carpenters, the farmers? So if you're in one of those three professions, then you definitely have the means to further your prosperity. Carpenters, okay, you know, carpenters help build ice houses. Blacksmiths are designing equipment that would need to be used for, you know, harvesting ice and all. And the farmers are might as well be known as the ice harvesters. Well, I thought that after the winter of 1869-1870 would probably be the last of the mild winters, but of course, as we learned early on, New York City would, over nearly a 50-year span from the 1870s till World War I's end, would have to rely on main ice from the Kennebec River region immensely due to the fact that that city faced a lot of, deficits in terms of overall ice harvest yieldings that were not up to par. But did another mild winter sensation incident occur not long after the one from 1869 to 1870? The answer is yes. The next incident happened in 1880. And once again, ice harvesters from the Pine Tree State. You know which state is called the Pine Tree State? It's Maine. So once again, ice harvesters from the Pine Tree State of Maine came to the rescue of their fellow brethren to the south in Pennsylvania, New York, and Maryland. And probably the same for Massachusetts as well. Sawdust, we learned some time back, became the saving grace for helping insulate ice, most notably in Maine, given that the shavings of sawdust were left to stay stagnant in the rivers and thus resulting in disrupting the proper flow of sediments and nutrients. But sawdust still remained in high demand for insulating ice. But marsh hay became greatly used for insulation, and marsh hay basically is hay that's located in upper areas of brackish coastal salt marshes. During the winter of 1879 to 1880, marsh hay doubled in cost from $5 to $10 a ton. In the winter of 1879 to 1880, saw around 4,000 men and 350 horses working round the clock along a four-mile stretch of the frozen Kennebec River. Do you want to find out about this rough estimate figure? I think it's breaking news in a way. $600,000. That is the rough estimate amount of what was paid to the entire workforce on this four-mile stretch of the Kennebec River, whom harvested and loaded ice. The cost of shipping the ice was around $1 million. One can only imagine how much that would be in today's time in terms of money, but for $600,000 in terms of the rough estimate of what was paid to the entire workforce on this four-mile stretch of the Kennebec River, that's awesome. I mean, and to think that, you know, you have, you know, 4,000 men employed. So you would certainly have made sure that all 4,000 of those men got their equal share of what they were entitled to via compensation purposes. A man by the name of Henry Hall, whom was a special agent, he conducted extensive research findings that led to confirming a total of 36 ice companies on the Kennebec River, which included 53 ice houses. Hall's findings were published 3 years later in June of 1883. And if 36 ice companies on the Kennebec River, including 53 ice houses, is a high enough of a number onto itself, how about the number 1,735? That's the number of vessels whom were involved in the ice trade up around that time. 1,735 vessels. All right, now we're going to focus on a scientist here, and I know that most of you don't know who this guy is, and that's okay, because I didn't know anything about him until having read the book, along with doing some research through good old Wikipedia. Yeah, to think at one time there was no such thing as Wikipedia. If you wanted to look up something about someone, you actually had to look up through, I remember this years ago, my parents had a collection of these encyclopedias. They don't have them anymore, but they were. You know, it's a shame I can't even remember the title. It's pretty sad, but it was an encyclopedia A through Z, and you know, it was more than just looking up definitions. They actually had write ups on famous people, and yes, folks, that even included former presidents of the United States. Matter of fact, the encyclopedia set that my folks had Ronald Reagan when he was first sworn in as president, if that tells you how old those World Book encyclopedias were, given that that dated back from the early 1980s. But anyways, the scientist that we're going to focus on here, his name is Ferdinand Carré. C-A-R-R-E, Ferdinand Carré. That's the best I can do with French pronunciation. So if anybody else were to tell me that I didn't pronounce it right, I won't be offended. But why is Frenchman Ferdinand Carré worth mentioning about? Well, for starters, he was an engineer. But secondly, he became a lead pioneer inventor of refrigeration equipment intended to produce ice. In the 1850s, his brother Edmund invented the first absorption refrigerator, which used a heat source to provide energy required to drive the cooling process by using water and sulfuric acid. The year 1858 saw Ferdinand build on brother Edmund's work, resulting in his creating a machine that used water as the liquid and ammonia as a gas. And in 1860, just 1 year before shots were fired down in Fort Sumter, South Carolina, in April of 1861, which marked the official start of the Civil War, in the year 1860, Ferdinand's patent got approved in the United States, where he successfully proved to find a way of recycling ammonia gas within a system which cut overall costs of manufacturing ice. Artificial ice manufacturers faced many challenges. They really did. Most notably involving a substance that is still used today. It was first discovered, I want to say, in the 1870s in northwest Pennsylvania, not far from the outskirts of Erie, around Titusville. But this substance is used worldwide. How about oil? So artificial ice manufacturers faced many challenges, most notably involving oil, given in the event oil itself, once it got onto ice blocks, what would oil do? Well, it would result in contaminating the commodity. Not just contaminating the commodity, but how about explosions? The Daily Times newspaper from Bath, Maine, reported in January of 1889 how an ice machine in Chicago, Illinois, blew up, thus resulting in fire to buildings and causing nearly $200,000 worth of damage. Probably in today's time, that would be in the millions. The ice industry in Maine was totally opposed to artificial ice manufacturing, and they had good reasons for it. As for the Louisiana Ice Company, you know, we talked about them early on. What were they doing? How were they functioning? Well, the numbers that I will tell you here may not seem grand, but it was good enough for them. For the Louisiana Ice Company's artificial ice machines, these ice machines yielded around 18 to 19 tons of ice per day, netting the company with a total sum of 45,000 tons. That's not bad. That's not bad for an area that's trying to do something a little differently, especially not only during what was going on during the Civil War, but well past the time that the Civil War ended. Of course, Reconstruction itself ended in 1877, but even in the start of the 1880s, a lot of Southern states have still not fully rebounded from the aftermath of the surrender that took place in Appomattox from April of 1865. But around the time of the 1880s, there were roughly, get this folks, 40 different styles or types of ice machines in use around the world. 40. With 100 getting patented in Washington, D.C. alone. So, you know, here we are. We've been talking so much about what's going on in the United States, but we forget that several other people out there are experimenting with refrigeration, and they're not all in the United States. We've got people in France. We've got people in Britain, or I should say the United Kingdom. The bottom line is that refrigeration will come about, as we know, modern-day refrigeration. It's going to take a little bit more time, but mankind is making strides. And mankind will eventually make strides to where he may no longer need ice to be shipped from one region to another, just to be able to ensure that people from one region who may not have had the luxury of having something that would keep their beverages and foods chilled long term. How do I say it? They will be able to one day. Be able to rely upon an invention that will be able to take the place of having the commodity be shipped from point A to point B miles, if not miles by the hundreds, and not so much miles by the thousands, but basically they will be able one day from now be able to enjoy something that that won't have to be purchased via long distance. Well, that covers it for this podcast segment episode. And when I'm on the air again next time, we're going to learn about competition that is west of the eastern seaboard from the Midwest. We will also learn about competition that also takes place on the eastern seaboard. But this kind of competition that we'll be focusing on is competition that is not healthy competition. It's competition that will either make some people all the more richer, while it will make others bust. In other words, make or break. Well, thank you for your time as always. And without you all, I don't know where I would be. I know I say that a lot, but it is true. Without you guys, I don't know where my podcast would be, but you all have made the difference. So wherever you all live, continue to stay safe and continue to be ardent listeners. Continue to get the word out to others who want to learn everything there is to know about historic events that are important, historic people that are important. Learn about it in a manner that's relevant, educational, because that's what I'm trying. That's what I intend to represent. I tend to represent all things relevant. Thank you again, and wherever you all live, please continue to stay safe. Take care.